Hi, this is the Planet Podcast, and I'm your host, Patrick Roanhouse, and today I have guest host, Tim Connolly. How you doing, Tim?
I thought I told you that it was pronounced differently.
Connolly. Connolly. All right, you like Connolly? I'll say Connolly.
Keneally.
Keneally? Oh, I thought it was Connolly.
Well, you know, you're one of the privileged few to actually be able to... I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to anglophile it just to piss you off, sir.
You bastard.
I know. So today we're here to talk about what we thought were cool news topics in the week. And I will start with the news of Google opening up its own public DNS.
Oh, man. You know, Google has their hands in everything. And I wondered when I first, you know, read about this, what, you know, what is their motivation? And obviously the motivation is to increase activity on Google sites, but like, I mean,
it's like, as soon as like, oh, you didn't go to the right page, we're just going to have all these links affiliated to it for you.
Yeah. We're going to resolve all of our, well, actually this is do you ever look at, Kottke.org, Jason Kottke? I think that's how you pronounce it.
No.
You know, that blogger, he pointed out that, Marissa Meyer was saying that, had like half of a second of delay in search causes like a 20% drop in activity. And he was saying that this is obviously why they want to get into DNS, because, you know, you can keep people searching, keep people going on. But I mean, who among the average Google user knows how to change their DNS settings? I mean, am I wrong here? Am I wrong in thinking that there's like, that's a very niche kind of thing?
I don't know. I mean, like, the fact you have OpenDNS so popular now, I know a lot of parents who use that service to block a lot of stuff. Like, for example, on Boltbus and Megabus, they both use OpenDNS to block, like, illicit sites. Like, if I want to get my 4chan fix while on the way up to New York for some press event, I cannot do so.
And I'm really? Like,
yes.
Wow. I had no idea. I figured the Boltbus was...
I know.
I could download bus porn or something.
Bus porn. Right. Okay. But yeah, like it worked for a while, actually. You could do the Google, you know, translate hack to get past it. And then they were like, yeah, we're just blocking everything that might be affiliated with any, you know, 4chan site. So
wow. No
more 4chan on the bus trips.
Crazy.
Yeah, I'm very sad about that. But I could see Google DNS being popular with, like, educational institutions and other people like that, because of the fact that it's Google. And so say if you have your business through them, you doing your email and corporate, you know, enterprise service through them. Oh, look, we have our DNS as well.
Yeah.
And I mean, granted, the idea that, oh, you typed in the wrong thing. Sorry, because of your configurations, we can't let you search for this. But here's some things you might be able to search for. So, like, if you had, like, say, a kid doing a report on breasts, it would block out all searches through Google that would be, you know, breasts of an illicit nature instead of breasts of a mammogram nature.
That is cool.
And so... there's an interesting side article that was written on internetnews.com with Sean Michael Kerner with a word from H.D. Moore. He's the guy who started Metasploit, which is a really big popular network security pen testing software set. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about how, surprisingly, the Google DNS, the way they set it up for randomizing the DNS requests and stuff like that, actually makes it less prone to the Kaminsky DNS flaw that was made famous in 2008. So supposedly it's pretty good. It's a little bit slower, they say, than OpenDNS.
Yeah.
But by barely any bit. And the thing is, it does jump you over to Google's search page if it can't resolve your stuff.
Which isn't bad.
Yeah.
And I read something that international users actually experience a greater jump in speed than US users are.
I'm a little worried about the fact that with China and other, great firewalls of nations, you know, how this might affect with them, because, you know, DNS is the first stopgap to limiting information for people.
That is one to really chomp on.
Yeah. And just to actually, as one last side note, BussedTees.com already has taken their line in the sand and has put out this T-shirt that says what they feel about Google. And if you're looking in the enhanced podcast right now, you can see the image of it right now with a very, very not happy looking man.
Hilarious.
I know. Skynet, it is in the future, they say.
And here I spent all this time thinking that, that Google was going to be like Deep Thought from Hitchhiker's Guide, but Skynet is way more accurate now.
Okay, so what's your story? What's, what did you say?
One of the really important things that we're looking at in the U.S. is wireless spectrum for data.
Mm-hmm.
And last month or 2 months ago, Julius Genachowski was saying, you know, we've got this spectrum crisis on our hands where our demands for wireless data are so high that it's practically impossible for them to be fulfilled with things as they are. So there's going to have to be this dramatic change in who is using what bits of the wireless spectrum and the acquisition of licenses and how it's going to have to speed up so incredibly much. And this week, the FCC put out a notice of inquiry,
mm-hmm.
which asks for people to say, here's what you need to do for the national broadband plan mm-hmm. in respect to the spectrum. And so, you know, it's only a couple pages of a document, but they have like about halfway down, it's like general approach to how we're going to do things. And they mention that a potential approach could be to share the 6 megahertz channel in markets where, you know, it can be shared. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that that's like a, That's a channel used by broadcast television, and we're gonna be hearing a lot about this in the coming weeks. About, you know, is this viable? Are we gonna have like broadcast television causing interference issues with mobile broadband data? And personally, I love conflicts like that. I want broadcast television to go away. And
I hear you on that one.
I'm all for total data. And, you know, total streaming everything, and such as things like Hulu and Comcast's Fancast Xfinity or whatever
yeah.
have you. So, and that's my attempt to create a segue into your story.
Well, it's to just talk about the at first I thought it was saying like 600 megahertz, but I'm like, okay. Oh, it's only at the 6 megahertz, which actually makes sense because data propagates faster when you have it at a lower frequency. Like, anyone that's using AT&T's phones knows that when you're on the higher frequencies, you tend to not be able to get as well of a signal. But if you're using Verizon, who are at a lower frequency range, you tend to get a far better signal reach through buildings. And the fact that they're using 6 megahertz would be like having someone put a large giant speaker and have like – it's like the episode of The Simpsons where it's like, all you sexy snakes, come to this room.
I love that one.
I know. That was a great one. Like,
Barry White.
Best episode ever. But it would be interesting because, I mean, I find it really kind of funny because you brought up – this goes into my story as well with Comcast. But the idea that you have media providers like fighting tooth and nail to be like, oh, we want the spectrum. We're like, hey, just go straight digital, all right? Just treat it as digital. And the fact that you would have – if you could open up like the entire broadcast wave that was supposed to be for broadcast television
mm-hmm.
and get the entire world saying just everyone switch to a straight digital signal
mm-hmm. –
you know, you open up all the spectrum that would allow for how many megabits per second for wireless communication.
You know, that's like looking at the licensing chart. You see all of the things allocated to broadcast, and I mean it's substantial, and you can't help but think like, why? You know, mm-hmm. I need it for data, so give it.
What would be funny is if they open up that entire spectrum, because they already have the 700 megahertz spectrum, which is one part of the broadcast for the UHF. But if they went to – like if they were able to open up the entire spectrum from, you know, the VHF to UHF and then have it treated as white space, you know, data transmissions, I mean no one would get in anyone's way.
Exactly. I mean that's what happened with the part of the 700 megahertz spectrum. T-Mobile uses it for their 3G. And that – I mean I know a lot of people speak ill of that, but it's a very – what's the word I'm looking for? Pragmatic use of the white space. So,
yeah, it'd definitely be interesting to see if maybe the 600 megahertz gets the same open access that Google was able to force in for the 700 megahertz spectrum.
Yeah.
All right. So my story that continues on with this idea of television broadcast is Comcast buys NBC Universal. Story coming out of CNN Money is that Comcast is buying up 51% of the ownership of NBC, with 49% still going to GE. and GE is taking the initial 22% that Vivendi had in the stake of the company. Yeah, I really do not like this story at all.
It's a hard one to like. I was going to say Comcast, from anyone's perspective, is evil. So, you know, any growth there is just going to instantly be viewed as, like, we're going to suffer. So
I just, like, as soon as I saw, like, Comcast buying a media company, that automatically means, oh, we don't want our media on iTunes. We don't want our media on Hulu. Oh, wait, that's right. We're major owner in Hulu. Oh, let's just close this thing. Everyone use Fancast instead. I mean, I'm like, just, like, just the implications of Comcast buying the media just makes me very just cringe.
And the, you know, they said, oh, this will allow us to increase local and children's programming, and we will offer, you know, fair deals with our rivals. But, you know, that's a lot. I have absolutely zero faith in that statement.
I think when it comes down to faith in Comcast, I think when they said, oh, when we buy Tech TV, we'll keep it the same, pretty much sums up what I believe is truthful about Comcast.
That's a sore spot for me.
Dude, that's for any geek, I think that's a sore spot. I mean, Leo Laporte still talks about it today.
I you know, those were such golden times, and now look what it is. It's sort of like MTV, you know, how they used to play videos. Well, you know, there used to be technology on what is now known as G4 or whatever.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is just some of the stories that came out of the Engadget spheres about Hulu, saying like the new CEO of Comcast, who will be he'll be the same CEO of NBC Universal, Jeff Zucker, had said in a report that he wasn't going to do anything to Hulu. They were going to keep Hulu. And Engadget was like, yeah, because, you know, bugs in the way usually take a little bit of time to catch them before you can crush them. And then,
well said.
I know. And then, 30 Rock's, actor, Alex Baldwin, said that he was interested in seeing how his character would react. Like, he always thought that, like, something like this, because his character is a GE executive, the character, Jack, Dowie, said that he would love to have him hide in his office, and he wouldn't come out till Jack Welch, who was a former executive of GE, comes up and tells him his orders.
That would be. I would love to see that play. I don't know if you watch that show, but
I've started to grow into it. I didn't like it at first, but Hulu is what made me catch on to it.
That commercial with Alec Baldwin doing his thing.
I think it was actually the thing that really got me was Tell It to Me in Star Wars, where they're talking about the Uncanny Valley. That is what really sold me on the whole thing.
That show is good. People really relate to it, and I do like that. Oh, my train of thought just completely crashed.
It's okay. Trains can crash, and on the way they can talk about how they carry goods and services from Motorola.
Oh, yeah. Like the La Jolla, which is it caught my eye this week, and being an Android fanatic, I hate to call myself a fanboy because I'm not like an apologist for Google or anything, but anything Android is really something I'm going to want to grab onto. And with Motorola's purported whatever 10 or more Android handsets they're supposed to come out with this year, Android and Me, which is an Android blog, found a flip phone running Android or what looks like specs related to that. And I am super interested in that because right now Android is stuck in the current like zeitgeist of touch phones, and you don't see it on any other form factors. And I kind of liken it to the way BlackBerry used to be locked into just BlackBerry, how it was the, you know, you got your QWERTY keyboard, you got your whatever 1.8 inch or 2.5 inch screen. So, you know, if Android can branch out into other form factors like a flip phone, I'm super excited about that, and I think it has a lot of potential.
Yeah, the way this phone looks from the – they're showing like just the idea of how it would look like. It's from the Sharp series, the W61SH from the link you sent me.
Yeah.
I totally like get this feeling like if you are going to see something like that, it's totally going to be like how Kyocera made Palm phones for Korea but never brought them to the States. Do you remember those?
I don't, actually.
Kyocera actually made some smartphones that were Palm OS, like the original Palm OS, mm-hmm. that were flip phones. And they were the first ones with EDVO, Rev A, and stuff like that. And like,
really?
They were pretty sick looking, but it's like, you know how they, how Asia always has these interesting, like, weird takes on phones, but they never bring them to the States? Because they're like, oh, America would never get these. We would not
yeah.
get these. Like, totally, if something like that were to happen, I totally feel that that would be like, you would see someone on a Japanese subway watching TV on one of these things rather than having an America. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and actually, you mentioned that it looks, it almost looks like some of the Verizon VCast TV phones, like the way it flips. It's like an LG phone almost. But
yeah.
When did that Palm phone occur? What year are we talking about here?
That was like 99, 2002, I think. Uh-huh. It was an older phone. It was running a Palm 5.
Wow.
My old roommate actually had one of them because he would travel to Korea a lot of times, and he was using it as his secondary phone for a while.
That's awesome.
All right. So talking about the land of the rising sun, we're going to talk about PlayStation. They are now 15 years old. They can they're getting their learner's permit.
That is just awesome. I of course, it makes me feel super old, but
yeah, don't even get me started.
Looking at this made me think of like my first real experiences with the PlayStation, and I gotta say, they weren't good.
All I gotta say is Battle Arena Toshinden.
See, and the old dude whose attack was like a fart. That
that was so terrible.
That cracked me up when I saw
the polygons. The polygons ripping apart as you moved around.
Oh man, but my first experience with that was. I didn't play it for the first like year it existed. I didn't get my hands on it until like 96 or 97. And the first game I played was so bad. It was one of those X Games racing games with like inline skaters going down a mountain or something. And I was looking at it like, this is just garbage. And then the second game I played was Ridge Racer, which I don't really care about racing games, but for some reason the person who had the PlayStation, all they had were racing games and Toshinden. And I was like, if this is what the future of gaming is, I'm sticking with my, you know, I'm sticking with Super Nintendo.
Yeah, I loved how boxy all the polygons were, and then all the textures were just slapped right on. So it was like, yeah. It was like someone put like, you know, that fake wood veneer that people put on that's got like the sticker veneer that was from like old computers that people have?
Yeah.
Like, it looked like that, I thought, visually speaking.
And that, like, is great way to put it.
Thank you. Because, like, you would be turning on, like, you're playing, like, Ridge Racer or one of those other motorsport games, and your character would be like, all right, and he's moving his arms up and down, and all of a sudden you see, like, the box open up, and you see inside of his arm, and you're like,
yeah, the hollow. But then you got to compare it to what was going on at the same time in the 32-bit era, like, the Sega Genesis 32X.
Yes.
How about that?
All right, that works. And I think what's funny is, like, they have on Engadget, they had this little roadmap. It's actually a screenshot from the Sony PlayStation's 15th anniversary page, which I'll include in the show notes, but it says 1995, then nothing till 2000, then it jumps to 2000, like halfway through 2000, so it's like basically PlayStation 1, many years later PlayStation 2, probably the slim version of the PS1, and then like 2005, like 4, it's PlayStation 3, and then probably the slim of the PlayStation 2, and then like PSP, 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 then PlayStation 3 Slim, PSP Go. I'm looking at this map, I'm like, I know exactly what each of those product launches would be. But it's like, it's funny because I remember like the big hoopla about, you know, when PlayStation went to PlayStation 2 and they changed the name from being like, the branding was Home Entertainment System to Home Entertainment Computer.
Yeah.
Because of the whole tariff tax, because if it was a system, it would be considered a toy and they had to pay like an exorbitant amount more fees.
I love that.
And now it's back to Home Entertainment System again for PlayStation 3. But, like, how they were so trying to, like, saying, it's a computer. See, we have Linux on it. And you're like,
it's not.
For a sync on green screen. Okay. So, yeah. Your story, good boy.
Okay. Back to the ever-present Google and how it – we have to love our master. They are working on visual search for Android phones, which is kind of exciting to me. When we talked about this earlier, you mentioned TinEye. Is that what?
Yeah, TinEye is the image search engine software.
Yeah, so I mean, it turns your camera, your Android camera, into basically like a search field, and whatever images you capture become sort of like the queries. I mean, that's an abstract way of saying that Google will tell you what your camera is looking at. And I don't know. I've been a really big fan of augmented reality, and I like the idea of an augmented reality search engine. And that's – I think that it's not going to take over or anything, but advancements being made in that field are like super interesting and could be just incredibly useful. And I think once, you know, Google pushes this out, it'll land on Android, then it'll probably land in a semi-crippled fashion on iPhone and then everywhere else. And we're going to get a big jump in visual search.
I see this being useful in two places for me.
Yeah.
One is particularly in the fact that if I'm ever really, really drunk and I don't know where I am, I take a picture of a random sign and it can find where I am.
God, I could have used that a couple of times. Last night was one of them.
And two, if I was a girl, the ability of being able to take a picture of a skeezy guy and hopefully, like, who's talking to me and saying, oh, he's not on the most wanted list.
Wow. See, that didn't even occur to me, the facial recognition or search like that.
Because, I mean, a lot of that information about who you, like search a predator stuff now, they have, like, the whole, like, registries where they have to have a picture now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one quick picture, and if you're unlucky enough to match, you might be listed as Skeezy Boy.
Wow. That's pretty crazy. I don't know how accurate those, you know, like the facial vectors and everything are at this point. But, I mean, that's something for people to be terrified of.
Well, I think a lot of times you can actually, like, it's surprising how good image searching can be. Like, with TinEye, I can put in a picture of a celebrity, and it will find a bunch of other ones that can have listed. TinEye's not exactly as great for, like, you know, aggregating. So I can only imagine what the power of Google would be like. They already have the ability of saying, I just want a face, or I want a line art, or I want this. And then maybe doing something off that. Like, if they can find other pictures that have similar, you know, styles. Like, other people who took the same picture of someplace at night while drunk.
Yeah.
Or, you know, same person in a club or something like that. You never know.
Common places where drunk people get lost.
Yes.
Did you mean this street? Yes.
Well, talking about learning machines in particular... interesting story from Wired Magazine, particularly about a new program from the Cornell Computational Synthesis Laboratory, in which Cornell was able to make a software program that could take large data sets and be able to extrapolate the mathematical relationships from the data. And it was able to write the formula for, or actually infer Newton's second law of motion through all the data sets. And this was done without any human interaction.
Watching the demo video is just pretty staggering, actually. Mm-hmm. Like, how it can give you the equation based solely on the results is – I think that's amazing.
And it's pretty interesting, the technology for it, because it's using a lot of AI like biological AI algorithms where it's like, at least if it doesn't first succeed, try again so you can start moving. And a lot of this is used in robotics in particular. Mm-hmm. But the applications of this to specifically doing mathematical formulas is pretty much a first. And I actually was really compelled with this because I can only imagine if you were to take this program and apply it to, say, I don't know, what kind of data sets are coming out of, you know, the LHC. What kind of formulas could they infer from that?
You could figure out a lot of things. Well, not you. A machine would, but...
And thus, humankind gets dumber and machines get smarter. And I, for one, welcome my future robotic overlords.
Any advancements we can make in robotic learning is just going to, like, completely put us at a disadvantage to our robotic overlords.
And what I find really interesting is the fact that they completely offer the Eureka project spelled spelled E-U-R-E. Q-A, not the typical with the K, like, you know, Eureka in a bathtub kind of Eureka, but they provide the actual application for free download from Cornell's website, too, and I will have that in the show notes. And looking at it, I'm like, ooh, I'm going to do some naughty things.
I love how it has, like, the distributed computing model built into it.
Oh,
like, that awesome. When the demo got to that part and it lists, like, the other computers in your network and then how you can harness them, I was like, this is what I want.
Yeah, it was actually, they said they were able to, from just the raw data they provided it, it was able to figure out the Newton's second law of motion in under about 4 hours. And I'm like, that is a pretty sick.
Just thinking of things, even not physics based, but things like, you know,
like path optimization problems and things like that. Like knowing to turn only right for UPS.
Yeah, exactly. Or I was also thinking for like economic, you know, applications, like people putting in, let's say, oh, I don't know, just tax figures and things like that, how it could predict the
new laws of mathematics to be found every day kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, the next story for you, what do you got?
Lala. It's the name of a Teletubby, I believe, but in this case we're talking about the streaming music service, which was reportedly acquired by Apple last night. That would be September. What the hell am I talking about? December 4th.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
It was either New York Times or Wall Street Journal. Someone tweeted that, yes, the deal is done. Apple has bought this streaming music service, which essentially lets you buy a stream of a song for an unlimited amount of streams for 10 cents a song, which is actually a really brilliant model for, you know, music sharing and music sales, because as we move into the cloud, if you're one of the believers that we are going to move fully into the cloud, this is, you know, this lets you have access to music anywhere. And so with Apple having this, since they have arguably the most prominent music store online, offering a subscription, or not, it's not even really a subscription service. I don't know what you'd call it. Like, what would you call Lala?
It really is real, just streaming mostly. I think you purchase the tracks. Like, what's really interesting is the fact that Lala is now predominantly, like, it's a searched item. Like, when you type in a music track, if Google has it on Lala, like, they'll put it right there on front page.
Oh, that's right. That's the whatever one, not one box. That's something else, but it's something. Yeah. If you type in a song title or lyrics, that will come up and you can stream it from right there.
Mm-hmm.
But if Apple takes it, will that continue to exist?
I don't know, man. I think the one big thing is, I think that Apple is like, it's inching slowly to a thing where you'll have like a home central server system.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that you're getting away from having the physical purchasing of your item, like you already now are used to just downloading music. So the idea of having a CD with a higher quality is no longer a subject matter to most people.
Yeah.
And the streaming, I have strong issues with it. I think this is Apple trying to get in front of Spotify.
Yeah.
And, you know, trying to do something with that. Because that's the most likely scenario. Is Apple's like, oh, we have to get in front of Spotify. And this will probably be like the first, like, they'll probably say, if you want to have, like, say, add this to your monthly agreement on your cell phone or whatnot, you'll probably be able to get the service for an additional, like, $5 a month, I bet. So, like, any tracks you already own are included with your thing, so you don't have to have them synced up to your phone when you go, or, you know, something like that.
The question that I have that is, it's sort of more of a general thing, but 10 cents a song is, I don't know if that is devaluing music. Like, this is a question that musicians have had for a long time, because you know, back in the day when you put out an LP, you know, you'd be making a ton of money. And but now musicians don't even make anything. And when you have unlimited access to a single song for 10 cents, I mean, you're going to pay $1.20 for a whole album. I mean, that's almost impossible to, you know, musicians will not be able to make a sustainable living, even if they're selling these streams directly.
What's really funny is when you mentioned that, there was a story in Gizmodo, this is a side thing, talking about artists, you know, getting paid. A guy from the band called Too Much Joy.
Oh my God. Crush story. I love
that. I love that story.
That band is quite underrated. So go on. I didn't read this. I'm very intrigued.
It was on Gizmodo, and it's about how, this guy from Too Much Joy, one second, what was his name? Does not say, but he, Tim Quirk, singer from the punk, pop outfit, Too Much Joy, signed on for Warner Brothers in 1990, and he proceeded to, because of cost of the initial, you know, how getting a record contract works is they give you money to make the first album, and then you have to pay it back.
Yes.
So they said that the total amount of money they gave him was roughly $400,000, mm-hmm. and of which up to today, since 1990, he has only received one royalty check for $62.47, while saying he still incurs a balance of $395,214.71.
The music industry is undoubtedly broken.
And well, the one thing that's really funny is the fact that Tim now works at as the head of Rhapsody's acquisition services. So he knows exactly how many times his songs have been played to Rhapsody and how much they're paying Warner Brothers, and he knows that they're screwing him.
Well, I'm just going to say for your listeners, you should download some Too Much Joy, because they, not only are they – I don't know if you've ever listened to them. They are actually a humorous band and have a lot of funny songs that are very catchy and upbeat and very 1990s if you're into that sort of thing. So for Tim Quirk's sake and for your own sake, go download some Too Much Joy.
I will I will try to give it a listen.
How about what's going on with PayPal?
PayPal recently started mistaking its own emails as phishing attacks.
Hilarious.
That, I mean, like, really, how bad is it nowadays when your own company thinks that their own emails are phishing attacks?
See, I was sort of suspect. I mean, I have a preconceived idea of PayPal. I hate them. But reading this story, I have to open it. I can't remember the guy who found it out.
Randy Abrams, Randy, Microsoft staffer.
Okay, yeah, Randy Abrams. How did he know that it was an actual PayPal email? Because the link went to his PayPal site?
A former Microsoft staffer who is now director of technical education at antivirus firm Esten Abrams complained about the inclusion of a link in an email from PayPal, as it looked rather much like a phishing email. Let's see. It says PayPal support staffers responded not by noting that Abrams may have a point because the link looked so suspicious, but saying, oh, it probably was just a phishing attack, when in fact it was a legitimate PayPal email.
There's just so much going on here. It's like, it's hilarious. Like, so PayPal sends out this email, which is sketchy because it's got a link in it. And someone sends it back to them and says, this is a sketchy email. And they say, yes, it is, because we didn't send it out, even though they actually did.
Yeah, it's to go to show that when you have the links that come for logging in and checking in things with PayPal are so grandiose long now.
Yeah.
That, like, it just becomes like, oh, we can't really tell because it's so long now. Like, PayPal needs to take a book out of the tiny URL playbook and just say PayPal, and then have a user account number. Mm. I mean, granted, speaking, you know, user account numbers might be scary, but if you know it's just for you, then it's just for you. And then, not to mention, talking about the whole Unicode thing recently with ICANN supporting that.
Yeah.
Oh, don't even get me started on that.
Don't worry, I won't.
All right, good, 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 good.
I will actually say, though, that I checked out this story because I've – working at Beta News, I've had this hearty – skepticism, you know, built in. So I pretty much check out everything. And I checked out – I emailed PayPal to see if the response that Randy Abrams got was actually an automated one, because it looked kind of suspicious to me, because it said, Dear Randy Abrams, like in the beginning, like rather than like, Hey Randy, or Dear Sir, or Dear Mr. Abrams. But in fact, the response that he got was not automated, and it was a legitimate thing. PayPal was actually – taken in.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So the next story, talking about the motion of things. What is this? What do we got here? We got I'll let you have this one.
We all know about Tiger Woods and his his car,
especially because of Chinese 3D graphics visualizations.
This is just like. you know, people rubberneck at car crashes. People rubberneck with celebrities. A celebrity car crash is like just the most – no human being could look away. It's the most intriguing thing we could have. So because everyone is looking at this and because some photographs showed the inside of his car, Tiger Woods is, I guess, he's a nerd. You know, he's got this physics book sitting on the floor of his car. And people are looking at that, and suddenly the sales of this book just skyrocket.
Well, the thing is, to get this really right, though, it is a physics book on golf. So it's called Get a Grip on Physics by John Gibbon.
Oh, so it actually is about golf.
It is about golf, but it's about the physics of golf.
Okay. I guess that part eluded me when I was reading the story. I just thought it was a straight-up physics book.
Yeah, because it's a pretty old-looking cover on the front of it. Like, they have this picture on the guardian.co.uk's website for the story. And it looks like something like you'd see like from the 50s where it's like, get a grip on physics.
Oh, yeah, it does.
And what's funny is like the story, it jumped from – it originally was at like number 396,224 on Amazon's list. And in the last week since it was spotted on the pictures on in the news, it's jumped up to number 2,268.
Which is a jump of like – it's like an 80% jump.
Yes. I mean, it's... That is a I have to say for Mr. John Gibbon, he is a very lucky man.
It makes me think of when people buy, you know, products that they see their celebrities – using, like their favorite celebrities, they buy their clothes, they buy their but I can't think of a better thing for people to like suddenly pick up than a physics book, even if it is about golf. I mean, I think that's pretty fantastic. I mean, didn't the guy write a book about, you know, Schrodinger's cat?
Yeah. Like, he's best known for In Search of Schrodinger's Cat, which is a really good book explaining how quantum physics has mystified people, in particular explaining how when things happen, it actually, like, if it doesn't take just left and right, it does both at the same time.
Yeah, I've tried to explain that cat thing about how it's alive and dead at the same time to a number of people, but I'm not a good explainer of physics or of quantum physics especially. But it's a great story.
And the one thing that I wanted to talk about before we close out is I'm a huge fan, as I said earlier in the show, of websites that propagate memes such as 4chan. And a meme that has become popular lately is one of Lieutenant Geordi LaForge with a text macro on it says, "If you're having core problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a breach ain't one." And that is a combination of the Jay-Z song 99 Problems. And I am proud to say that someone on Reddit took it upon themselves and actually turned it into a real song.
This is like the ultimate nerdcore rap type thing. They're taking the Jay-Z song and taking sort of the Weird Al approach and the mimetic approach. And I think it's great, actually. Especially I like the bit talking about LeVar Burton. He's like, "I have other roles. I was in Roots." You know?
What's funny is there's two versions of it. There's the first one, which was just a straight lyric track. For example, one of the tracks says, particularly in the song where the cops pull over Jay-Z, it says, "Son, do you know why we use the tractor beam?" And it says, "'Cause I'm young and I'm black and my visor's real low. And do I look like a Bezoed? I don't know." Well, and then it goes to say, "So are you beaming aboard? Should I guess some more? Well, you were doing warp 5.5 in a 5.4.
That's actually and Jay-Z's lyrics in that part were actually really good too. Like they had a very strong foundation for this.
I think this track is just really fun to hear, and for the listeners of the podcast, we're going to close out with this one for the ending credits today.
Yeah.
I'd like to thank you, Tim, for being a co-host today on the podcast.
Thank you, Patrick. This is a great show, and I look forward to listening to not just this one, but all of them in the future.
Where can we see more of your work, Tim?
Betanews.com is where I do most of my work, which is focusing generally on the mobile world, mobile phones, mobile data, mobile spectrum, mobile such like that. And I have a blog known as Android Bakery, which goes even more specific and does Android. You can follow me on Twitter at Tim Connealy, C-O-N-N-E-A-L-L-Y.
Tim Connealy, it's been great having you today.
Thanks a lot.
All right. And this has been the Plan 8 Podcast. Have a great day.
If you're having core problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a breach ain't one. I got Retro Patrol on a white team zone. Don't need to worry about having my casket closed. TV critics say it's stick to reading Rainbow. I'm an actor, stupid. What types of facts are low? I'm like, fuck people. I was in Roots 2, asshole. If you don't like the visor, you can press fast forward. Stardate 1265.4. Up on the screen, it's the motherfucking war. I got two choices, y'all. Stop the ship or fire the torpedoes, try to breach their core. Now I ain't trying to start no stellar race with my crew, but plus I got a few phases and can modulate them too. So I cut to impulse and I put them on screen and I hear,
sir, do you know why we use the tractor?
Because I'm young and I'm black and my visor's real low. Do I look like a betazoid? I don't know. So are you beaming aboard or should I guess some more?
No, you were doing 1.5 in a 5.5. Federation IT. Shields down, man. Does your saucer separate? I know a lot of them can.
I ain't deactivating shit. All my paper's legit.
Well, do you mind if I look around the Enterprise a bit?
Well, my shields are all up, and so's the hull in the back. And I know you gon' need Class 4 scanners for that.
Oh, well, aren't you rationals attack? Some kind of Vulcan or something? Somebody important or something?
Well, I ain't past the academy, but I know a little bit. Enough that you won't illegally search my ship.
See how smart you are when the Klingons come.
I got 99 problems, but a breach ain't one.
Crazy!
99 problems, but a breach ain't one. If you're having more problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a breach ain't one. 99 problems, but a breach ain't one. If you're having core problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a breach ain't one.